Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Last night, Donald Trump accepted the Republican Party's nomination for president. The Washington Post came out with a fact-checking piece as Trump was still speaking, called A Dark Vision Based on Specious Facts. The piece was a compendium of doomsday stats, according to the Washington Post, and it falls apart upon close scrutiny. Numbers are taken out of context, data is manipulated, and sometimes the facts are wrong. 15,000 reporters were in Cleveland covering the convention this week. So with wall-to-wall coverage, where were the facts? And where are you seeing coverage of the xenophobic and fear-mongering speeches? Melania Trump's plagiarized speech got wall-to-wall coverage and analysis. But where was the coverage of the Republican Party's platform, the most extreme in memory, according to the New York Times? It includes an abortion ban with no exceptions for rape and incest, and a call to make Christianity a national religion and require Bible study in school. John Nichols has been in Cleveland all week, and he has written about the party's platform for The Nation magazine, where he is the national correspondent. He's also co-author of the new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. We had his co-author, Robert McChesney, on the show about a month or so ago. And John Nichols joins us from Cleveland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Rose, and a pleasure to be talking about talking with you after a week of talking with folks at the convention.
I bet. Well, we're excited to hear your perspective and analysis on it. Thank you for joining us. We're also today going to talk about coverage of the attempted coup in Turkey last week. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has declared a three-month state of emergency. He's cracking down very hard on teachers, civil servants, judges, soldiers, and others. Up to 60,000 people have been fired or suspended for alleged links to the coup plotters. And joining us to discuss coverage is Karim Shaheen, Middle East reporter with The Guardian, and he's joining us from Ankara, Turkey. Hi, Karim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
It's great to have you back. So before we dive in and talk about these issues, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that really stood out this week. So John, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, it's intriguing that we'll be talking about Turkey as the show goes on, because my highlighted piece, or the one that I was most powerfully struck by, appeared on the German site Deutsche Welle, which is a very, very popular site in Germany. And it's on Turkey. It's actually a discussion with an author, and it's titled Turkish Author Burhan Sönmez and Our Society Should Not Be Left to Anti-Democratic Politics. And it is a examination of the core small-d democracy issues that have come into play in Turkey, not just with the coup, but also with the current government's approach before and after the coup. And I thought it gave such good perspective. I also loved that it's very poetic in its embrace of democracy. Just a terrific piece.
And John, where did you see that piece again?
It's Deutsche Welle.
Deutsche Welle, okay.
The German.
Yes.
You'll find it quite easily.
Great.
And it's a lovely piece by a Turkish author talking about democracy and democracy in hard and complicated times.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I definitely will ask Karim to give us a little bit of context about what's been happening in Turkey for people who might not be following it. Karim, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
So unfortunately, I've been running around Ankara for much of the last week, so I haven't had the opportunity to read a lot of long-form journalism. But I do have to say the coverage by some of my colleagues here in Turkey of the coup and the crackdown in its aftermath have been absolutely incredible. Mehul Srinivasa for the Financial Times has done an excellent sort of TikTok account of what's been going on. Emre Peker at the Wall Street Journal as well has done a really fascinating piece looking into how the coup unfolded. As well as other colleagues in Reuters have also revealed information such as the fact that some fighter jets had President Erdogan's plane in their sights and were harassing it as he was flying from his holiday resort to Istanbul, and really came close to getting killed in that incident. So there's been some really great reporting out of the country over the last few days. The Washington Post team as well, Aaron Cunningham and Hugh Naylor, my colleague in The Guardian in Istanbul, Patrick Kingsley. There's been some really great coverage of the coup and its aftermath.
Well, let's dive in and talk about what's been happening. And before we talk specifically about the coup, Karim, for people who might not be familiar with Turkey or what's happening there, we're talking about a country of about 80 million people. The BBC ran a piece recently called Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's Ruthless President. It says, to his supporters, he has brought Turkey years of economic growth, but to his critics, he's an autocratic leader intolerant of dissent who harshly silences anyone who opposes him. Dissenters range from a 16-year-old arrested for insulting the president to a former Miss Turkey who got into trouble for sharing a poem critical of the Turkish president. So can you give us a little bit of context here? Who is this man? What is life like under him?
So the key thing to understand about Turkey right now is that it's an extremely polarized country. As you mentioned, Turkey has 80 million people. It's an enormously important geopolitical player. Its borders are shared with countries that have been racked with instability. There's an 800 mile border with Syria. There's a border with Iraq. The country has over 2 million Syrian refugees who've taken refuge there since the start of the Syrian conflict. It's the second largest army in NATO, a very crucial U.S. ally. Although relations have deteriorated over the past few years under President Erdogan's measures over the last few years that have been more authoritarian, and as well as President Obama's general disengagement from Middle Eastern politics. So President Erdogan he used to be prime minister. He became president after elections in 2014. He was a long time prime minister. He led the Justice and Development Party, the AKP, initially founded on a platform of that was pro-business. That wanted more talks with the EU on Turkey's possible accession to become a member of the European Union, moderate Islamist policies, and general support for business and development in the country. And under the AKP's leadership, there was indeed enormous improvement in the economy, lots of growth. Turkey became a trade hub, lots of tourism, increased prosperity in the country. And in as time wore on, the AKP has consolidated power because it has won very significant majorities over the past several elections that have allowed it to rule as a single party government. And over time, President Erdogan has solidified that control by appointing loyalists to the bureaucracy, to the police force, to the judiciary. And in the past couple of years has clamped down a lot on media freedoms. A lot of television stations and newspapers that are allied or that are accused of being sympathetic to the movement that allegedly carried out the coup last weekend, a lot of the media outlets have been closed. There's been a crackdown on dissent. The president has been very intolerant of any criticism directed at him. I've interviewed journalists such as Can Dündar, who is the editor-in-chief of the main opposition newspaper, Cumhuriyet, several times, and he was imprisoned for a story that he published about Turkey sending arms to Syrian rebels. He's gone through countless prosecutions and lawsuits. So this is kind of a summary of that, and in addition to that, there's been an ongoing insurgency in the eastern and southeastern parts of Turkey by Kurdish separatist groups. There was an ongoing peace process that collapsed recently, last year in particular, after several bombings that were carried out by states in the country, particularly targeting Kurdish activists, and then later on targeting other areas in Turkey, including the airport last month. So the ongoing insurgency has also added to the sense of insecurity and the clampdown on freedoms and media freedoms over the last few months. This is sort of the background.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's so important. John Nichols, do you have any questions for Karim about background context or why this coup took place?
Well, I've followed it obviously very closely, and I'm certainly tremendously impressed by what he said. I'm particularly interested, and he may be able to give us some great insight on this, by what I thought was a very impressive coming together of political parties from extremely different perspectives to oppose the coup. And there was a small d democracy moment there that I'm not sure was as well covered in U.S. media as it was, say, in The Guardian, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, especially seeing the party of the left that has been so battered by the government or by Erdogan stand up basically on his behalf to say, you know, we can't have this coup.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a crucial element, and it's not lost on the AKP and government officials that a big part of the reason about why they haven't been deposed is because the opposition also supported the president's call for people to go out to the streets and resist the coup by popular demonstrations. So these are parties that include the HDP, which is the main Kurdish party that have been accused by the government of supporting the separatist rebels in the east and the southeast. So these people came out to defend a government that for all intents and purposes was they hated, and so their participation in the opposition to the coup was absolutely crucial in preventing its success, and their involvement was definitely a moment for I think all of Turkey to be proud of its people's defense of democracy and of its democratic institutions, and that's a big part of why the ongoing crackdown now is so problematic, is because is the government going to learn the wrong lesson from this coup, and is it going to persist in its purge of the bureaucracy, the judiciary, the police, and so on, in its effort to catch the alleged perpetrators of this coup attempt, or is it going to try and work together and bring the country together, in order to achieve some sort of peace in the aftermath?
Karim, how were you able to determine the makeup of the people who were on the streets fighting the coup? Because there was so much information on Twitter about people taking to the streets, but then we saw these very disturbing images. In fact, one of them was on the cover of the New York Times a couple of days ago, showing people lashing soldiers and beating them. There was a case of an alleged beheading that went viral. How were you able to determine who these people were?
Well, I mean, in terms of those specific incidents, it's obviously difficult to determine who exactly were the people who did this, but there was ongoing violence in the streets. Tanks were firing on people. There were helicopters firing on people. I went to the Forensic Institute in Ankara, which was in charge of returning the bodies of dead civilians and soldiers and police officers back to their families. And there was immense anger at both the coup plotters and the government for failing to predict this coup attempt. And so I have no doubt that there was violence in the streets by people who were able to apprehend soldiers and officers who were taking part in the coup, particularly whether it was as a response to the fact that they were attempting to overthrow the government or as a response to the violence that they had been subjected to. That's impossible to tell without speaking to the perpetrators of that violence.
And Karim, what happens from here? I mean, what are you hearing from people who've been arrested? What are people on the streets talking about? Or people who've been fired also from their jobs?
So, I mean, the scale of the crackdown is absolutely incredible. I mean, as you said earlier, there have been, I think, around 20,000 teachers who've been suspended from their jobs. We just got news that 283 special forces soldiers who were stationed in the presidential palace have been detained. We have 9,000 members of the judiciary and the military who've been detained or arrested. We have, you know, about a third of Turkey's generals have been implicated in the coup and have either been suspended or detained and relieved from duty. And you know, the issue here is that you know, who are these people who are being detained? Obviously, you know, if some 30,000 people or 50,000 people or however many have been detained in connection with the coup so far were involved in the coup, then you know, it was probably the worst kept secret in all modern coup history. The issue is that the government is accusing these individuals of belonging to a movement called Hizmet, which is a group of a grassroots organization that answers to a man called Fethullah Gulen, who's a reclusive cleric based in Pennsylvania in the United States, and used to be an ally of President Erdogan for a very long time. Was involved his organization was involved in the prosecution of military officials in the past over the past 10 years. In Turkey, officials who had been accused of attempting to overthrow the government, and then they turned into really bitter enemies in 2013 when Gulen's organization launched a corruption investigation into President Erdogan's inner circle, and after that relationship collapsed. And so the ongoing purge is basically targeting individuals that the government accuses of belonging or having sympathies with the Gulenist movement. It's extremely sketchy, you know, what they're actually basing that on. I mean, how are you a member of the Gulenist movement? Are there any particular criteria? Do you have to, you know, have given money to the organization? Do you have to have, you know, worked for any of their newspapers? And so on. It's a massive organization, has a presence in, I think, 170 countries. So it's extremely difficult to discern how they're actually going to identify, you know, who was an accomplice of the coup plot and who was not.
Well, Karim, thank you so much for providing us with analysis and giving us context. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian. He's joining us from Ankara, Turkey. He's been doing extensive reporting about what's been happening on the ground there, and you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to talk about media coverage of the Republican Party convention and Donald Trump's acceptance speech last night. He is officially running as president of the United States on the Republican Party ticket, and joining us for the rest of the hour, John Nichols, national correspondent with The Nation. He is in Cleveland. And now I would like to welcome April Glazer back to the show. April is a freelance journalist, former staffer at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where she focuses on digital rights. Hi, April. Welcome back.
Thank you. Hi.
Great to have you. So I want to ask both of you, what is the role of the media during events like these? John Nichols, you're in Cleveland. 15,000 reporters are there. I think it's really important to make a distinction between print media and broadcast media. Frankly, I was disappointed with PBS NPR. I didn't get much fact-checking. There wasn't that much information. They sounded more like moderators to me. So I just wonder, what is the role of the media during an event like this?
It's a terrific question. And I think it's important to understand the media not as the individuals who may do a good job, and certainly not as the fact checkers or the, you know, even the TV hosts or whatever. You have to see it as a whole, as an entity unto itself. And if you fail to do so, you fail to understand it in the way that political power now understands it. the way that conventions work is a political party brings together its base, and it puts its candidate and its leading figures up on the stage in a basically very theatrical production. There's a little bit of Sturm und Drang, there's a little bit of disagreement, but at the fundamental level, this is a show. And they bring the media there to present that show, to be the transmitter of that information. And they recognize that within this mass, within this huge entity, 15,000 folks, that there will be dissenters. There will be those who say, you know, but hold it, that's not true. Those who ask the tough question, those who challenge the conventional wisdom. That doesn't bother them, because their general sense is that in the overall product of all that media will be something beneficial to them. And they especially build toward this incredibly theatrical last night. The Republicans did it. The Democrats will do it in a week. And this is just pure production. It's very, very low on content, very, very high on, you know, theater, right. Even down to the balloon drops. And the only thing that I would emphasize about this is that power sees the media in these situations as the vehicle by which they get what is referred to as a bump, i.e., that they get so much publicity, so much attention, that they'll go up in the polls. There's some evidence that that's actually going to work for Trump, that he will have some benefit out of this. And media people ought to pause and think about this and question whether that's a role that they really want to play. And it's a tough game, because you can't not cover these things. But by the same token, overall, media has become a tool of the political parties during these conventions, rather than sort of a free-functioning and an independent entity.
Well, and I think at this point, we all know what we're going to get from the cable shows and networks like CBS, where you had Les Moonves, the CEO, telling investors, go, Donald, go, because he's making them so much money.
That's right.
But we
That's
should
right.
have higher expectations for public radio and public television, don't you think?
We should have higher expectations for all of media. Look, we have a freedom of the press protection in the First Amendment of our Constitution, not because Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or anybody back there, you know, was all that thrilled by the newspapers of their time. It was because they believed that an independent, questioning, very skeptical media was necessary for the development of a democracy. That you can't have democracy unless people have a free flow of information that is separate from and challenging to those in power. When you develop a media system so driven by profit, so driven by ratings, so driven by clicks, that it becomes, in many ways, an extension of power, you undermine the basic concepts that this country started with at its best. And remember, America's made a ton of mistakes over the last 200 and some years. I'm not saying we were founded in any kind of perfect moment, quite the opposite. But that was one thing they really got right. This idea of a diverse and challenging media. And what I would suggest to you, Rose, is that the way to think about this is at a much deeper level, that our politics has become such a big money production that our media, be it public broadcasting, be it independent, be it small, be it big, today our media has become an extension of that big money and that power, rather than a counterbalance to it.
April, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think the role of the media is during an event like this?
Well, you know, I certainly agree with John that that democracy can't really function very well without a pluralistic media. And, you know, and the media, so far, you're right, that broadcast has been looking at this as kind of a theatrical show and looking for the kind of drama points as opposed to the deep analysis that has to happen, and I've seen that with a lot of online publications.
Right.
But unfortunately, they just don't get read as much
yeah.
or consumed as much. But for instance, The Intercept had a fantastic piece today about, you know, the oil lobbies paying the Washington Post and The Atlantic, of all people, to host climate change deniers and to have an event on that, you know, that type of analysis. Analysis, I've seen numerous reports analyzing Peter Thiel's role and whether or not, you know, these billionaires are going to have a level of support beyond just Thiel, or if he's like an oddity in this space for Trump and his conservatism and his, you know, ties to libertarian politics. You know, there's definitely a question that I would say print media has explored quite well, or not well, but has covered the fact that protesters were quite tame compared to past years, despite how divisive this election is. And I think that a question I would have liked to see explored more is, where were the protesters? Why didn't they come out? Do we not have information environment or a dissent environment that is encouraging to people to you know, invest time and energy in going to a political event and showing a level of opposition, which we didn't see, yet we expected to see this year because of a history of that.
Right.
And so that type of analysis, I think, is really what helps to kind of keep Americans informed about the rest of America. The point of media is that, you know, I know what my inner circle is thinking. I'm on social media. I follow people I'm interested in, but I don't know what other people are thinking, you know, and I didn't see that kind of, that human-centered level, or that kind of, following the money type of thing that, that I would have liked to see in more popular channels.
Yeah, you make great points, and that's why I said I like to make a distinction between the print and broadcast at times, because I think print media has done a really good job this week, and we'll talk more about some of these pieces. In fact, the Washington Post got its hands on Donald Trump's speech before he gave it, and so they fact-checked it as he was speaking, and then they printed a story last night, pretty lengthy story, about a lot of facts that he got wrong on the economy, on immigration and crime. So big kudos to the Washington Post for this. And we'll talk more about really good reporting that came out of the convention this week. April Glazer is a freelance journalist, former staffer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She just completed a fellowship at Wired. And John Nichols is national correspondent with The Nation, co-author of the must-read new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. What did you think of the coverage that you saw this week? Melania Trump's speech that was, some parts were plagiarized from Michelle Obama, got wall-to-wall coverage and analysis. But where was the coverage of the Republican Party's platform, for example, the most extreme in memory? John wrote a piece about this called Donald Trump Will Lead a Theocratic Party into the Election. We'll talk with him about that right after the break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, April was talking about following the money. That's what we're going to do on Monday. We'll talk about the corporations funding the Democratic and Republican parties. Who are the Democrats' corporate friends, and how do they compare to the friends of the Republicans? And then we're also going to talk next week, as the Democrats kick off their convention in Philadelphia, we'll talk about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy record, her policy on women and girls, and we will also do shows about democracy. What's the state of our democracy once these conventions are over? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. We're talking about coverage of the conventions. 15,000 reporters were in Cleveland this week. What did you make of the wall-to-wall coverage. If you listened to the PBS NPR coverage, what did you think of it? If you watched the cable shows, what did you think? If any articles stood out for you, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. John, you wrote a really good piece, Donald Trump Will Lead a Theocratic Party into the Election. You write about what is in the platform. The New York Times had a really good editorial called The Most Extreme Republican Platform in Memory, but it didn't get that much attention this week.
No, it did not. And this is, you know, part and parcel of the tragedy. We have a deeply unsettling political class in this country and a media class that reflects it. And the deeply unsettling thing is that they immediately say issues don't matter and stances on issues don't matter. So you'll hear people all the time say, well, nobody reads the platform. Nobody takes platforms seriously. It doesn't matter. Well, that's completely wrong. Whenever someone says that to you, understand right off the bat that they're ignorant. The fact of the matter is, if you go to a platform hearing, it's packed with powerful people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Power understands how important it is to define a political party, that it is in the platform fights that you actually push at the candidate and begin to define the candidate. And so the platform is such a vital, vital part of any political party, and yet it is almost universally dismissed, covered briefly, anecdotally, by broadcast media, if at all, and frankly, by an awful lot of print media. That's the mistake, because if you wanted to cover this convention, you had to cover the platform.
Right.
It is there that you see two important things. Number one, that Donald Trump, to unite a party that has been hard to unite, that didn't really want him, ceded all the social issues for all the nice talk about the LGBTQ community in his speech last night and things like that. He ceded all the debates about social issues to the religious right. They got what they have wanted for 40 years. They wrote a platform that actually suggests that state governments should tell school districts to develop curriculums in which the Bible is used as a historical text. There's all sorts of other elements of this that are just remarkable. There's one sentence in it that mentions God six times.
Mm.
Now, I have no problem with mentioning God. You know, that doesn't bother me at all. But the fact is, they're driving home a vision of how our politics ought to operate. And you need to understand, I know you do, Rose, and your listeners do probably as well, but it's important to point out that while that may not be that big a deal in California, there are states in this country where this is a day-to-day battle. And that got locked in, baked into the Republican platform. That's number one. The number two thing, very quickly, is that how Trump approached the platform tells us an immense amount about the possibilities of how he might approach the presidency. He was willing to cede huge areas of public policy to extreme figures because he didn't want to bother with it, right? That's something to think about, because if he was president of the United States and he decided to cede, I don't know, education policy to the evangelicals, just imagine where that takes us. So this should have been discussed front and center all the time. It was dramatically, overwhelmingly more important than whether Melania Trump borrowed a line from Michelle Obama.
Exactly. I mean, as you point out, people for the American Way's Right Wing Watch said that 4 years ago they called the GOP platform a far-right fever dream, and they said this year's platform is even further to the right. April, the other thing that stood out for me as a woman is the platform's extreme views on abortion. So the official platform now says that the Republican Party opposes abortion even in cases of rape and incest. And I repeat that on the show because it doesn't get that much attention. I mean, the Republicans wouldn't touch that issue of rape and incest 8 years ago, and now they're embracing it 100%.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a question, like, why isn't this getting covered? Why isn't this considered news? Why are the you know, theatrics or the blame, which is true, but, like, Milana's plagiarism more newsworthy than, you know, women's reproductive health in the United States and a major party's representative platform on that? You know, and I think in terms of media, I think that broadcast media, who actually has a tremendous amount of room to be creative, mm-hmm. and more creative than print media, in that they can speak to people. It's animate, their voices, you know, it's more colorful than just words lined up on a screen or on a page, aren't being creative enough with this. You know, they're not going out and speaking to women across the country in Trump-heavy supported areas and seeing if they agree with this.
Right.
Platform, you know, we're not getting that kind of bringing America to America, which broadcast could do and has done in the past, that type of analysis and that type of kind of on the ground, kind of getting the pulse of the people, response to the platform. And I completely am taken aback by how shallow the conversation has been, you know, around the facts of the platform, for sure.
John, can you elaborate on that again? Because also the party invokes, quote, natural marriage. It defends merchants who would deny service to gay customers. It rejects the need for stronger gun control. It wants to appoint, quote, family values judges. The Bible should be taught in public schools. I mean, this is a lengthy platform.
Oh, it's a huge platform, and it's packed with, you know, all sorts of elements that we should be talking about a lot. I mean, because we just nominated somebody to run for president. There's polls that show him running even in a lot of battleground states. This is not Trump's candidacy. Is certainly not irrelevant. He may lose, but he is certainly a very credible contender on the baseline measure of, you know, is he getting support? And he's going to be running for president on a platform that seeks to obliterate trade unionism in America, literally get rid of it. That's got no taste for, you know, minimum wage increases or basic economic justice, that looks for all sorts of privatization of existing public services, public education. And then you get into the parts that we focus on, and I think it's completely appropriate to focus on, and that is, you know, where it's genuinely hurtful, where this platform is harmful,
yep.
to people simply in its statements.
Yep.
And that is where you get into the sections on the LGBTQ community, where, you know, literally you have things said and approaches to all sorts of issues that frankly, you know, say you aren't welcome, we despise you, we want to change you. Remember, this is a platform that has entertained, you know, discussions of conversion therapy,
mm-hmm.
right, where you force mm-hmm. people to become what they are not.
Yep, exactly. I'm glad you brought that up because, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, was on the PBS NPR live coverage from the convention floor. I mean, they did not ask him one question about conversion therapy, which is proven to harm young LGBT people. In fact, researchers call it torture. And then you had Jerry Falwell Jr., who was interviewed by Steve Inskeep yesterday morning, and hardly any pushback questions. Why is this, John? I mean, you know, with Roger Ailes stepping down from Fox, I want to do a whole show about how Fox has really affected the rest of the media. I just wonder, why aren't we getting tougher questions from these people? I mean, April makes a great point. Broadcast media is the best place to do this. It didn't happen this week. Why not?
No, but it doesn't ever happen. I mean, it's very, very rare that we get a satisfying, dose of media coming out of one of these things, and that's why you have a very good show. But the important thing to understand is this has something to do perhaps with Fox, and we should do whole shows on it, unquestionably. But it also has something to do with the triumph of celebrity and sports culture in America. Politics is now covered as a celebrity enterprise and a sporting enterprise. And so as a result, you are obsessed with personalities. I mean, can you imagine it? We just had a convention where we saw, you know, all of Donald Trump's kids give, you know, major addresses, and they were analyzed as if this mattered, what his kids thought.
Right.
And then, secondly, though, the sporting metaphor is where you get the answer on your Perkins interview. Perkins is not appearing there to talk about ideas, to talk about, you know, to debate proper procedures, proper policies, proper programs. He is on there as the representative of a voting bloc. And this is a sports program. They are saying, well, you know, how will the ball be moved down the field? Will the evangelicals help to do blocking here? Will they catch the pass? That's what this is. This is not, so he's not brought on to talk about ideas. He's brought on to talk about strategy and you know, can Trump get this voting bloc on board for him? And this is killing political coverage in America. Mm. It is literally destroying it, because we don't cover politics anymore. We cover strategy.
We have an email from Leslie who says, I was appalled that even MSNBC fell all over itself about Trump's offspring, leaving aside their generally vapid speeches, except for the parts that Ivanka filched from the Democratic Party platform. For those of you who didn't watch it, Trump's daughter Ivanka last night sounded almost like a Democrat, talking about equal pay for women, paid time off, child care for mothers. The rest of them were screaming lock her up when it came to Hillary Clinton, especially Chris Christie's speech. She says, how can one be impressed that children of privilege are well turned out? Furthermore, one cannot judge a parent by his children. Trump has admitted his first two marriages failed because he was never home. He did not raise his kids. They were raised by their moms and their nannies. Thanks for that, Leslie. Tom says, really appreciate the analysis. Now when you follow the money, you get to CBS and CNBC, Fox, etc. It's hard to imagine them not repeating anything Trump says when it brings ratings. Who needs fact-checking? We can no longer expect journalism from the same people who are beholden to the money. I do want to give kudos to The Washington Post, because they came out with a piece as Donald Trump was speaking, looking at the facts he got wrong. I mean, he talked about crime, crime, and crime. I think his motto, other than make America great again, is going to be law and order. And he said the number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by 50% compared to this point last year. Washington Post says that's wrong. The number of law enforcement killed on the job has increased 8% compared to this point last year. Overall, the number of police deaths has decreased over the past two decades. April, you know, I do fact-checking in real time sometimes on this show, because we take calls and people say things and I want to make sure that it's right. It's so easy to search for it. So we should expect this kind of fact-checking these days, right?
We shouldn't just, we should expect fact-checking, but and also, you know, just straight-up reporting, right?
Yeah.
Like, If the Republican platform is saying that conversion therapy, which it does say, is part of their platform, then get somebody, a psychologist or somebody who has been studying this on the line to help to unpack that statement.
Right.
You know, because really a well-informed, like without a well-informed public, people aren't going to be voting in good faith. And the way to be well-informed isn't just to regurgitate or to air what's going on and to just, like, say what's happening, but actually to dig in a little bit and to analyze it, so that way after somebody happens to turn on the radio for 5 minutes while they're cooking dinner, they can then sit down with their significant other or family and talk about what they heard that goes a little bit deeper than just what was said, right? And it's offering those kinds of conversational tools, that type of knowledge, that really can help to spark debate. That's why journalism is so important. But we haven't seen good journalism like that on these broadcast channels in a very long time. You know, John is certainly right about that. But you know, I wish we did see more of it.
Democracy Now! Also had someone on from the American Immigration Council who said that Donald Trump and a lot of the speakers were lying about immigration's committing crime over and over again. And according to the American Immigration Council, it says for more than a century, a number of studies have confirmed two simple yet powerful truths about the relationship between immigration and crime. Immigrants are less likely to commit serious crimes or be behind bars than the native-born. High rates of immigration are associated with lower rates of violent crime and property crime. And again, this is according to the American Immigration Council. And we are talking today about media coverage of the convention, Donald Trump's speech, with April Glazer, freelance journalist, John Nichols, national correspondent with The Nation, co-author of the new book, must-read new book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. And John, what are your thoughts? I mean, we are getting some good fact-checking from the Washington Post. There's factcheck.org. They do great work. There's a site kind of like Wikipedia that takes a look at the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, fact-checking is vital. And the only thing that upsets me, well, let me start in a much more positive way. I think what's happening at the Washington Post is incredibly positive. They are really becoming very aggressive as an institution in challenging both parties and challenging prominent political figures. I like the evolution of the Post. I know a lot of people who write for it. I'm frankly impressed by what they've been doing on the campaign. It's one of the real positive media stories of this campaign. However, I will offer one bit of caution on fact-checking. Fact-checking, as I think my colleagues suggest here, that, and as you've suggested, Rose, as well, that shouldn't, it's not very hard, and it shouldn't be something that we segment off into specialized sites. You know, we now have something like factcheck.org.
Right.
As if, well, does that mean the rest of media isn't fact-checked? And we ought to ask ourselves that. And the answer to the question is a deeply, deeply unsettling one. And that is that our media outlets have cut back so much on copy editors, on actual fact checkers, on...
John, did we lose you?
Hello?
Oh, I think we lost. John, are you still there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm saying that our media outlets have cut back so much on fact checkers and copy editors and reporters and editors that we end up with a situation where the very good, very sincere folks who are out there trying to cover a story have so many demands on them that, you know, we kind of like barter off the fact checking to these specialized sites. That's not healthy. It's not how it's supposed to work, because factcheck.org or other folks, they can't catch every lie and every flaw. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't catch the biggest of them all. And so what I would suggest to you is we suffer from a for-profit media that is so obsessed with profits that it's willing to cut out those aspects, those components of a media that assure that what is published, what is broadcast, what is put online is true. And that's a really, really big concern of our time.
Right. Well, we have time for one call. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I find the show somewhat depressing because there's a whole lot of venting. But I have a question in terms of action of the guests. You pointed out the distinctions between what Donald Trump says and what the platform says with respect to a whole host of reactionary issues. My question to the members of the media is, how can we get the media to, during the time between now and the election, to ask Donald Trump, who will be on the air all the time, I'm sure, well, how do you reconcile what you say and then cite some aspects of the platform?
April, what are your thoughts?
You know, I mean, I it's hard to say what is going to push, you know, a media that is so driven to make profits to actually doing real analysis up until the election. But I will say that activist movements across the country have shown that when there is a strong enough and vocal enough and persistent enough opposition, that the media is forced to cover it. right, or forced to cover when something's wrong. So I don't know if it's going to be a matter of the media just kind of getting injected with some sort of, like, desire to start reporting, you know, in good faith and start doing a better job with this, or if we're going to have to see enough groundswell from opposition and dissent, whether it's action, you know, planned actions and protest, that will actually kind of force a political moment for them to cover. But that is certainly hard to say. I think that the print places where there's quite a bit of diversity right now, mm-hmm. Have been doing a good job. I would like to see that transcend into broadcast as well.
John, what are your thoughts?
I think there are wonderful journalists doing a great job. When they get near Donald Trump, they will ask him good questions, and some of them will ask about the platform. That's vital. But in the broadest sense, I think especially in broadcast media, again, we go back to those sports metaphors, we go back to that kind of like desperate, constant covering of the momentary rather than looking at the big picture. The way that we break out of that, frankly, is to, you know, really look for different ways of organizing and structuring our media, making a better media that is, I mean, much more diverse, much more independent, much less profit-driven. But secondly, and I think in the immediate, and our caller is concerned about the media appropriately, so press for opening up the debates. Get more candidates into the debates. I know that seems like an odd way of coming at it, but the fact of the matter is, if the Libertarian Gary Johnson and the Green Jill Stein, if they're included in these debates, that will, for a variety of reasons, force a deeper discussion on the issues. I promise you that will occur, because it happens in every other country in the world. We're the one country that pushes away most parties from our debates.
Right.
And so become passionate about that. I think that's a very good way to get more discussion.
Well, it sure happened when Bernie Sanders finally started getting media coverage. The whole conversation changed.
That is sure right.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
And we are in the process. I'm glad you brought that up, John. We're in the process of booking Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, and hopefully they'll be on the show in the next couple of weeks. Just quickly, John, what are you working on right now?
I am working on, I'm about to go to the Democratic Convention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you understand we'll go through this all again for a week. But I'm just finishing a piece that's titled "The Banana Republicans Had a Lousy Convention," but that's not necessarily a problem for Donald Trump.
Wow, great
and it's
name.
About how Trump is separating from the party.
And April, quickly, what are you working on?
I am right now actually taking a look at Rio, fast-forwarding a little bit for what's going to happen with the big Olympics games there, with such a culture of terrorism and then the subsequent security state that's followed. I am examining what's happening to the people in that city and what the government is doing to prepare.
Well, we just had Jules Boykoff on talking about Rio, and so we'd love to get you on during the games to talk about this. John Nichols is national correspondent with The Nation, co-author of People Get Ready, and April Glazer is a freelance journalist, former staffer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. John and April, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about corporations funding the Democratic and Republican parties. According to Open Secrets, pro-Hillary Clinton PACs have raised over $350 million. Some of that money comes from corporations and nonprofits that are not required to reveal their names. So who are the Democrats' corporate friends, and how do they compare to the corporations backing the Republicans? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.